We are live. Oh, there we are on YouTube. I'll just wait a second, make sure it's working on Facebook. And on the website. Oh, there we are on the website. And there we are on Facebook. All right, I think we are good to go. Hey, Connie on Facebook. We'll just wait another minute or two to see who else jumps on. But I think we are working. You can let me know that you're here and that you're hopping on. I see a couple people on YouTube watching. I don't know if it's, yeah. So, well, welcome back to Wednesday nights. Hi to the few people who are hopping on. I see a few people watching. So, welcome. We, week two of our series in Genesis. Oh, there's Sarah Buchert. Hello, Sarah. Good to see everybody on here. Yes, so if you are just joining us, this is actually week two of our Wednesday nights through the book of Genesis. We started last week, and just to kind of bring you up to speed and let you know about how, Austin's here. Hey, Austin. How we want these things to, or tonight to work, to make it, you know, fun and interactive. Basically, I'm going to teach through a section of Genesis. We're going to try and do the rest of chapter 1. We only did two verses last week. But as I go along, if you want to kind of interact and add comments, or if you have questions that come up as we go along, you can type them in the comments section. And I'm on my iPad here, I've got YouTube and Facebook and the website up, so I'm kind of keeping an eye on the comments, and any questions or stuff that comes up, I will do my best to answer them. So last week was kind of an intro to the book. We looked at the first two verses of chapter 1 of Genesis, and really just tried to lay some groundwork for how we view the book of Genesis. How do we read it? How do you interpret the book of Genesis? And so we just kind of laid, that's why we only got through two verses. We laid a bunch of groundwork. So what we talked a lot about last week was, you know, ancient cultures and the different creation narratives that these different ancient cultures have. Basically, every ancient culture had a creation narrative, basically a story of how the world came into existence. That would really, the purpose of these creation narratives was to frame up a worldview, to answer some basic worldview questions. You know, why are we here? What is the meaning of life? Where did we come from? You know, all of these different types of questions. So all of these ancient cultures have these types of creation stories. And so Genesis, which was written by Moses to the Israelites, it's a part of the Pentateuch, the first five books of our Bible. You know, it was their law. So basically the purpose of Genesis was to say, you know, in the midst of all of these myths, here is the true story of the one true God and how he created everything. And so basically Moses wrote this down for the Israelites to teach them and to show them, here is these answers to these worldview questions. So Genesis 1 to 11 is what we call primeval history, basically. It's a history of the world in general, right? It includes creation, it includes the fall of mankind, it includes the story of Cain and Abel. It includes Noah and the flood, the Tower of Babel, all of these kind of general human stories. And then Genesis 12 to 50, right, the second part of the book, it just zooms in on one family, right? And it's the history in chapters 12 to 50 is the history of the patriarchs. So you have Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and you have the beginning of this nation of Israel, this people that God has chosen. So you kind of have those two parts of this book. So for the next however many weeks, we're looking at the first part of Genesis, which is basically a history of humanity in general. So verses 1 and 2 then of chapter 1 that we looked at last week, it formed an intro, really, to the entire creation story. If you remember, right, verses 1 and 2 says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the water." So there's this kind of intro statement, right, if you want to call it like a prelude, an intro to the book of Genesis, specifically to this creation narrative that we're going to unpack tonight. And basically you have, in the beginning, God creating the heavens and the earth, basically meaning God created everything. And the earth was without form and void. The earth was tohu, vabohu, right? That's the Hebrew. Basically, it means it's this desert wasteland, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God is hovering over the face of the water. So we talked last week, Genesis verses 1 and 2, it's not a separate creation account. Like, right, there's that idea of the gap theory that maybe Genesis 1 and 2 is kind of like God's first creation, and it was perfect, and then the fall of Satan happened, and it kind of made it into this desert wasteland, and then maybe the rest of chapter 1 is God recreating everything. But I don't think that that's, I wouldn't hold to that theory. I just think that verses 1 and 2 is like an introduction statement that then gets kind of broadened and fleshed out in verses 3 to 31. So it's like a summary statement. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then it's like, now we want to unpack what that entailed and what it looked like and the different things that God created. So tonight, we're going to see how far we get in the next hour or so. But we want to look at the 6 days of creation. We won't get into day 7 where God rests, but we want to look at the 6 days of creation. Now, right out of the gate, cards on the table, I believe that Genesis 1 teaches a literal 6 days of creation. I believe that when we read, you know, there was morning, there was evening, the third day, the fourth day, the fifth day, I think that Genesis is teaching us that these are 6 24-hour periods. So God created everything in the universe in 6 days. I know some people, some Christians, some scholars argue that, well, you know what, maybe each day is like an age, an eon. Maybe each day could be, you know, thousands or even millions of years. So maybe when it says like on the third day, maybe it means like this third age and this third, you know, it could be thousands or millions of years. And the idea is, well, they would point to a verse like in 2 Peter chapter 3 where it says, you know, with the Lord, one day is like 1,000 years and 1,000 years is like one day. So they go, well, you know, maybe when it says the word day, maybe it's like in God's eyes. And so maybe a day is not really just a literal day. The problem with that view is that nothing in the text or even nothing in the Hebrew language suggests that the word day means anything but a 24-hour day. There's nothing in the text that would suggest that. And really what you have is a lot of times when Christians think, well, maybe it is millions of years, what you're doing is you're taking an evolutionary worldview And the fact that, well, you know, it seems like science has confirmed that the earth is billions of years old. And what you're doing is you're taking that worldview and saying, how can I make the Bible fit into that worldview? Rather than the other way around, right? Rather than just saying, okay, the Hebrew suggests that it's just literally a day. How do I then shape my worldview based on what the Bible says? Now, for sure, sometimes the word day can mean a period of time. So for instance, in Numbers 10:10, this is what it says, on the day of your gladness also, and at your appointed feasts and at the beginning of your months, you shall blow the trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings. So that in Numbers 10:10, it says on the day of your gladness. And so it means day, kind of in this general term of a season of life. But the thing is that's a very rare instance. More often than not, the Hebrew word for day literally means day, 24-hour period. So that's why I just read the text and I go, well, nothing in here suggests that it was millions of years, because even then you have some issues that naturally come up. Okay, so on day 5, God creates, you know, animals in the sea, and he creates birds. And if that lasted for millions of years, well, then you would have death occurring. But the Bible is really clear that death was a result of the fall. There was no death before Genesis 3. So then you have to reconcile a whole bunch of things to go. And I read one scholar that said, well, maybe there's two types of death. Maybe there's natural death for animals over the millions of years. And maybe, you know, human death is what it's talking about. But when you try and take the Bible and then make it fit into the most popular worldview of the day, you just run into all sorts of problems. So the whole idea of each day being millions of years just doesn't make a whole lot of logical sense from the text. So I would love to hear maybe comments, maybe pushback. If someone's like, nope, I believe that the earth is billions of years old, that's fine. For me, I would say that if you are a Christian and that you believe somehow and you can have a good explanation for why the earth is millions of years old, for me, I don't think that's a salvation issue. I think it's maybe an issue of how we view the authority of the Bible, but I know for some Christians it's like, nope, if you don't believe that the earth is 6,000 years old, you are not a Christian. I don't go so far as to say that. I think that's a little bit drastic. Jennifer makes a really good point, which we'll get to. She says, I guess I wonder where dinosaurs fit. That's a super good question. And we'll get into that when it talks about the fifth day or the sixth day where God creates animals. That's a very interesting question. The only thing I'll say is we should not get our view of what dinosaurs were like from Jurassic Park, because I think that is highly exaggerated. So, but we'll get into that. That's a really good question, right? And here's what you have to understand. We're going to dive into some of the science of stuff, but even a lot of the science that talks about carbon dating and we can prove that the earth is millions of years old, a lot of even that kind of scientific method has already been called into question, going, it's not very reliable at all, how they date the layers of the soil and how they date the age of certain bones. Scientists themselves have come out and said, yeah, this is a super unreliable way to date, and we could be off by so much. So we'll get into that. But again, I don't want this to be a science lesson. I'm more interested in the biblical text, but we'll answer those type of questions and where dinosaurs fit into that. So yeah, good question. So please ask questions as we go along. I'll do my best to answer. So what we want to do is I just want to go kind of day by day, and we'll read the text about the day, and then we'll just kind of stop and make some comments about it. And like I said, we'll see how far we get tonight. So day one starts in verse 3, and it says this, and God "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. So, a couple of interesting things. You'll notice, okay, so we have day one being made. And you'll notice that it starts by, it basically said, "And God said, let there be light." So here we have a creation by speech as command. So this is a really important thing because the Bible talks about God creating everything out of nothing, right? It's not as if God, and it points to God's power. It's not as if God had a bunch of pre-existing material and then he decided to create stuff out of it. What we have even on this very first day is God simply speaks and things are created. So it's that idea of creation out of nothing, which is really important. Because if God had a whole bunch of matter and pre-existing materials and he had chemicals and gases and stuff like that and he could make things, then he would be like us because you and I can create things from other things, right? If I wanted to paint a picture, I would take pre-existing paint and a paintbrush and a canvas and I could paint a picture, right? But that's not what God does. God simply says, "Let there be light." And I love that it says, "And there was light," right? It just obeyed God. And so what's interesting, though, is that God creates by speaking, but then as we go along, you'll notice he sometimes also makes things, right? There are spots in the rest of the chapter where something is created or emerges by speech, but also there's like this subsequent activity that is divinely instigated. So let me give you an example. In verse 6, it says, "Let there be an expanse." So God speaks that. And then in verse 7, it says, "And God made the expanse," or another word is that he fashioned it. So it's like God spoke, right? "Let there be an expanse," and then he took it and he made it. So it's creation by speech, but also by God acting and doing something. Verse 14 is another example. It says, "Let there be lights in the expanse," but then verse 16, it says, "And God made the two lights." So it's both, right? We have creation by speech, and then we have creation by God actually, you know, doing it and making things. So on day one, God says, "Let there be light," and there was light. And it says that God saw that the light was good. That word can also mean beautiful. So God looks at light and he says, "That's good. That is beautiful." And then we're told that God separates the light from the darkness. And what you're going to notice as we go along is there's a lot of language of separating that comes up. And it doesn't mean pulling apart, right? If you think about, I can't think of an example, but it doesn't mean that I'm taking two things and like pulling them apart, physically separating them. But it actually means assigning each part for its respective spheres. It's the idea of God actually bringing order to the universe. God creates light and then he does this act of separating light and darkness, and what he's doing is he's creating order and function in his world. The idea of God separating things comes up in verse 4, verse 6, verse 7, verse 14, verse 18. Many times in the creation narrative it talks about God separating things, which is really, really fascinating. So it's this, it brings up this picture of God bringing order into the universe. God separates light from darkness. God is going to separate the waters above from the waters below. God is going to separate day from night. God actually takes a piece of a man and makes a woman, right? He separates them. And he's creating order and function. It's quite an amazing picture. And so one aspect, like I've been saying, is that of this creation narrative is here's a God who assigns functions and tells the universe how to work. So we're seeing a God that is fully in control as he's creating. So verse 5 says that he calls the light day and the darkness he called night. So here's a question that I think naturally comes up. Why doesn't God call the light light? Right? Why doesn't he call the darkness darkness? I don't know if your mind works like that, but I read, you know, God calls the light day. Well, I'm like, well, why didn't he just call it light? It's light, right? So basically, it kind of gives us this hint about what exactly God is doing on this first day, right? He doesn't call light light. He calls the light day. And he doesn't call the darkness darkness. He calls the darkness night. So here's a hint at God setting up a function in the world, right? The day is a period of light, and the night is a period of darkness. And so God separating light from darkness doesn't make a lot of sense if you just are talking strictly material objects, because light and darkness can't be separated logically, because by definition, light and darkness can't exist together, right? So if you go into a dark room, and as soon as you flip on the light, there's no more darkness. You don't have to separate it. Light and darkness can't be together. They're mutually exclusive. They don't exist together. So what God is actually doing in day one is he's separating, okay, there's going to be a period of light that he calls the day, and there's going to be a period of darkness that he calls the night. So really, God's first act of creation was creating time. God is actually, in this first day, he's setting up day and night. He's creating time. Because think about it, God is eternal. Before creation, there was no time. Right? God has just eternally existed forever. And so now on this day one of creation, God creates time. He sets up, okay, there's going to be a period of day or a period of light called day. And then there's going to be a period of dark called night. We've set up time now. Now, God's second act of creation is then to create space, which we're going to get into on day two. But I love that on this first day, here we have God creating time. And so as God sets to create out the universe, his first action is to create a 24-hour period, day and night. Now, here's what's super interesting about time. We're going to see in chapter 2, verse 3, when we get to the seventh day, right? And God rested on the seventh day. It says this, so God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work. So in chapter 2, verse 3, we see, okay, the seventh day is set apart as holy. So time, a period of time that is set aside as holy. And it's actually not until Exodus 3, verse 5, do you see a sanctification of space, where God says to Moses, take off your sandals, the ground you're walking on is holy. So before any, you know, part of the universe, before any space is set aside as holy, we actually have a period of time that is set aside as holy, which I just find super fascinating, right? God, the first thing God creates is time, and the first thing that he sets aside as holy is a period of time. So God creates light, meaning he kind of establishes light and darkness. He establishes the idea of time in the universe. But there's a question that people ask, and we'll probably get to it later. How can there be light on day one before the existence of the sun, which God created on day four? Has anyone thought that question before? I would love to hear. Oh, hello, Babaram. Good to see you watching from Nepal. And it's morning there, right? Good morning. Has anyone had that thought before? How could there be light on day one when we're told that the sun and the moon and the stars aren't made until day four? So really, the simplest explanation is God caused light to shine from a source other than the sun for the first 3 days. And I don't know what that looks like. Some people have said, well, maybe it was God's own glory that provided the light for the first 3 days, and it could be. Or maybe God just set up some temporary function for these first 3 days that caused light to shine, and then the sun kind of took over that responsibility on day four. We're not really given the answer, but one of the reasons we see light made on day one and the sun made on day four is because it creates this beautiful pattern in the Genesis narrative, which we'll get to in a minute. So that's day one. And like I've said, if you have questions about day one, you can ask. But on day one, God creates light. So day two, verses 6 to 8, this is what it said. It says, "And God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made the expanse and separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven, and there was evening and there was morning the second day." So day two, we are told God is creating space now, right? Day one was light. And basically what you see in day two is space, or if you want to, you know, the sky, essentially. Someone on the website says it may be as it will be in heaven. God himself is the source of light. Yeah, I agree. It very well could be, right? When you get to Revelation 21, I believe, and it says that there's no need for the sun anymore because the glory of God gives off light. So it very well could be. So on day two, day one, God creates time. He sets up that function in the universe by separating light and darkness. On day two, we see God creating space now. Now, I don't mean like outer space, but you'll get to what I mean in a second. Because God says, let there be an expanse. And the word expanse, maybe in your translations, it can also mean vault, or some translations might even say firmament. But the Hebrew word is rakia. Rakia, R-A-Q-I-A, if you use English letters. Rakia. And that word comes from the verb raka, which is just without the I, which means to spread out. So for instance, it's used, that word raka, the verb, is used in describing the temple when the artisans would hammer out the gold that went on, you know, the ark or the other furniture in the temple. So basically they would hammer out the gold so that it would spread out. That's that word. So God creates an expanse. Basically, it's quite an amazing picture. It's like God, you know, flattens this thing out and spreads it out, or hammers it out. Something that's created by stretching. So basically what God is doing is he's creating the sky, the atmosphere. He takes, because if you remember from day one, from verse two, the Spirit of God is hovering over the waters. So whatever that looks like, right? And then we're told that then God takes some of the water and puts it above the sky, above the firmament, and then he leaves some below, right? God made the expanse. He separated the waters that were under the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And again, notice that there's this idea of separating again, right? Creating order. God separates the water and he puts some up here and he puts some down here and he calls the expanse heaven. Now, that is not the word how you and, like, you know, the Christianese word, how you and I in the West would think of heaven. The word heaven simply means sky. It doesn't mean, you know, angels floating on clouds playing the harp. The word heavens here, you know, he calls the expanse heaven. That literally means sky. So God has created the sky. So think about it. It's such an interesting idea that God takes water and puts it up there and leaves some here. And now he's stretching and hammering out. Basically, he's creating the atmosphere on the earth. He's creating the sky. When you look up, right, and it seems like this dome that exists, right, from our perspective looking up, that's God creating the sky, the heavens. Now, a question that is brought up is, okay, well, is that firmament different from the sky that we have today? Right, because firmament seems like solid. And we know that the sky is not solid. So was there something different? And one scholar that I read, he actually had a very interesting theory. He believed that the firmament was actually a temporary canopy that God put in the sky. And his theory, and again, he said, you know, this is not a salvation issue. This was just a theory that he had. But he said maybe one of the reasons humans lived for so long before the flood, like some of them lived to over 900 years old, perhaps this firmament, this temporary canopy that God put in the sky protected humans from the sun, regulated the climate on earth so that it was ideal and contributed to humans' long life. And his idea was maybe at the flood, the canopy fell and it added to all of the water that drowned the earth. So the reason that he thought that was Genesis 2 verse 5 says, "For the Lord God had not caused it to rain on the land." There was no rain. And then in Genesis 7, when you get to the flood account in 11 and 12, it says, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, and the 17th day of the month, on that day, all the foundations of the great deep burst forth, and the windows of the heavens were opened, and rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights." So, I mean, it's an interesting theory to go, well, maybe God created this temporary firmament, and then at the flood, it kind of opened and the rain came and it flooded the earth. And maybe that's why after the flood, you see, you know, humans' lifespan drops dramatically, right? You go from people living 900 years, basically, and God says, well, I'm going to put a cap on it at 120 years old. Ultimately, though, what I think we're seeing on day two is God creating the atmosphere on earth. He's creating the sky. He's taking some of the waters and then he's putting them up in the heavens. So God, essentially what he's doing is he's preparing the earth to be a habitable? Basically a habitat where humans can live. Is that a word? Habitable? Anyways, he's ordering it. And he's setting it up, and ultimately, this is all moving towards this crowning achievement of his creation, which is human beings. So you and I, as humans, we cannot live without the perfect atmosphere on earth, right? We can't live without oxygen to breathe, and we can't. And so I believe that God, he's setting all of this up. He's flattening out the skies, and he's putting water above, and he's separating things. And so we're all moving towards humans being able to inhabit the earth. So day three then. Man, we are flying. I thought there was going to be more questions. Please ask questions if you have some. But day three, verses 9 to 13, this is what it says. "And God said, let the waters under the heavens be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, And the waters that were gathered together he called seas. And God saw that it was good. And God said, let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind on the earth. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed according to their own kinds, and trees bearing fruit in which is their seed, each according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the third day. So on day three, basically what you have is you've got dry land and vegetation being created, different types of plants. Jeremiah says on YouTube, a facility in the States actually made a habitat that might have resembled what they believed the atmosphere to be like and found plants, fish, and lizards to grow larger than average sizes. So maybe that's interesting. Yeah. There's so much information out there about creation. A great website is called Answers in Genesis. They have a lot of great articles and resources, and there's lots of other ones too. So yeah, who knows? So day three, essentially what we're seeing is God creates dry land and vegetation. He calls the dry land earth, but that word literally just means land. So it's not, you have to, it's not as if God's making planet earth, right? It's, I believe that he's just causing dry land to come up, because the word earth literally means land. So God creates dry land, and then he calls the waters that he gathers together, he calls them seas. So here's what's interesting. This is the last time that God will name anything. He names the light, he calls it day. He names the dark, he calls it night. He names the expanse, he calls it heaven. He names the dry land earth, he names the waters the seas. But you'll notice for the rest of the creation narrative, God doesn't name anything else. And the reason being, this is really interesting, the responsibility of naming is going to be delegated to the man, the humans that he creates on day six. And we're going to read about that in chapter 2, right? The man gives names to all the livestock and the birds and every beast of the fields. But I find it interesting that after this, after day three, God doesn't name anything else. Because it points to one of the reasons that he created humans, to have dominion and to exercise authority and to kind of be his image bearers on the earth, and he gives them responsibility. So this is the last time God names anything in these 6 days of creation. So God creates dry land, right? And I know that people have said, or some skeptics of creation, how could he create land and then have it be the perfect type of soil to immediately bring about vegetation, right? Because their idea is if land came out of the seas, it would be like soaking wet for days and days and days, weeks, months even maybe, before it could actually bring about vegetation. But I think what we're doing is we're forgetting the fact that God is doing these things. And there's a certain level of miraculousness to this, right? Like if we actually believe in the resurrection of Jesus, then it's not an issue for God to make the land dry quickly. So I think we're splitting hairs when we get into those types of questions. So God, he gathers the seas up and dry land comes up. And then it says that God creates plant life, essentially. And three types he Moses summarizes. He creates vegetation, he creates plants yielding seed, and he creates fruit trees bearing fruit in which is their seed. And then he basically says that there's each according to its kind. So basically what he's saying is that God created plants that yield seed, and he created fruit trees that yield seed, that they would continue to produce in their own kind. So basically what that means is that oak trees produce oak trees, apple trees produce apple trees, and so on and so on. You can crossbreed certain plants in their kind, but for instance, if I tried to crossbreed an oak tree with a fungus, it will yield nothing because you can crossbreed plants and vegetation and fruit trees according to their kind. And that's what he's getting at, right? These plants are going to reproduce because they have seeds, but they will reproduce according to their own kind. Now, here's what's interesting. The evolutionary view, which we touched on last week, is that everything in our universe came from nothing, right? So I'm not going to spend a ton of time talking about the evolutionary worldview, but this is really important. So the evolutionary worldview is everything in our universe came from nothing. There was literally nothing, and then a massive explosion happened, and all of life came from that over the process of billions and billions of years and things evolving and transitioning and morphing, including plant life. But here is where the logical fallacy exists within the evolutionary worldview. Plant life is, like, let alone, we'll just leave off animals and humans. Plant life alone is impossible to get to from an evolutionary standpoint, because the generation of life from that which is inanimate is impossible. The theory of evolution, you can only deal with systems that are already working. So by definition, that which does not function simply cannot evolve, right? Something that is inanimate and has no function cannot evolve. It's impossible for inanimate matter to produce biological systems by evolution. It actually can't happen. And what's fascinating is that is what we are being told. Well, that's what happened. There was nothing, and then there was an explosion, and then you have matter, and from this inanimate matter evolved biological life, which is impossible, right? So I find that so fascinating, because it's kind of pitched as, you know, the creation narrative is so outlandish and so ridiculous that there's a God who created everything by just speaking. And you go, really? Have you actually studied the evolutionary process? It's ridiculous. And it's actually impossible for it to happen. Not just like unlikely and good that there was billions of years. It's literally impossible for inanimate objects, inanimate matter, to produce biological life. Jeremiah says, just like the donkey, mule. I don't know what that means. Is that an inside joke? Oh, man. So here's what we have. This is really interesting. So days 1 through 3, really, you have God, I don't know if you can see, maybe I'm writing too far over. You have God setting up functions. And now we're going to see in days 4 through 6, God is going to begin to fill those spaces. So it's actually, the 6 days of creation are actually beautifully written, right? And there's all of these parallels that exist. So on day 1, you have God creates time, right? He separates light from darkness. On day 2, God creates space, the atmosphere of the sky. He separates the water. On day 3, God creates land and vegetation. So one scholar I read said this: on day 1, God creates the function of time. On day 2, God sets up the function that serves as the basis for weather. And then on day 3, God sets up the function that serves for the basis of food. So you almost have to picture, okay, days 1 through 3, God is setting up earth and the universe so that animal life and human life can then exist and fill those spaces, right? Because if you think about it, can animals or humans live without life or the atmosphere to breathe or land or food? And you go, well, no, human life, like if God created humans on day 1, they would die, So what he's doing is, it's like day one, two, and three, God is setting up this perfect habitat for animal life and human life to flourish in. He creates time, he creates light and darkness, he creates that function, he creates weather and atmosphere and oxygen, and he sets the sky up and he separates some of the water. He creates on day three land that they can live on, and he creates food that they can enjoy. So God is setting up, right, all of these functions. And then in day four, five, and six, it's like God's going to populate and fill these different spaces. So it's actually beautifully written, if you can tell. Like, you should get excited about this. It's fascinating how beautifully Moses has captured this for us. So, day 4, verses 14 to 19. And God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth." And it was so. And God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night and the stars. And God set them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth, to rule over the day and over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. Oh, now I get what Jeremiah is saying on YouTube. He's the donkey or the mule is like making things reproducing of their own kind. Gotcha. So day 4, God creates. I'm just gonna zoop, zoop, zoop. Day 4, God creates the sun and the moon and the stars, right, to fill and inhabit day 1, right? So God creates the sun and the moon and the stars. So again, think about it. Day 1, God sets up light and dark and time, and then on day 4, God fills that space with the sun and the moon and the stars. And so it's a progression from light in general to specific sources of light. So God creates the sun and the moon and the stars. And we're told that they're given three very specific functions. They separate day from night. They serve as signs for seasons and for days and years. So they serve as signs of the passage of time. And they illuminate the earth. So they're given these very specific functions, right? They help us separate day and night. They help us as signs of the passage of time, and then they illuminate the earth. Now, here's the difference between the Genesis creation narrative and other creation narratives. In most Mediterranean religions, the sun and the moon and the stars were considered to be divine, especially the stars. They were viewed as, well, those are autonomous bodies. The sun, the moon, the stars, those are gods that we should worship and serve. In our creation account, though, God creates a greater light, a lesser light, and the stars. He doesn't even give them names. He doesn't name the greater light. He doesn't name the lesser light. And the mention of the stars, you might have noticed, it almost seems like an afterthought, right? He says the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And then it says, and the stars, right? They're just mentioned. It's almost like an afterthought. And actually, that's very intentional, because in other ancient cultures, stars, they made a massive deal about the stars. Those are gods in the sky that we worship. And in the creation narrative, God says, yeah, I made a lesser light, I made a greater light, and the stars. So they're not a big deal, right? In Genesis, these luminaries aren't eternal, right? They are created. They're not to be served, but actually the greater light, the lesser light, and the stars exist to serve us, to serve humanity by separating light from darkness, serving as signs of the passage of time, and illuminating the earth. So it's a complete reversal of every other ancient creation narrative. Other creation narratives are, okay, the stars are gods and humans, you exist to serve them. And in the Genesis account, no. The sun, moon, and stars are created by God and they serve humanity with these various functions that they have. So it's quite amazing. The Genesis account stands alone and it kind of flips that narrative on its head. But also notice that verses 14 to 19, Moses doesn't care to be scientifically accurate. Again, if you listened last week, I said Genesis is not a science textbook. Genesis doesn't even care to actually answer scientific questions that you and I think that it should answer. Genesis is set up to answer worldview questions about who God is, how the world came into existence, and what is our purpose. So for instance, it says that God made two great lights, but the moon actually doesn't give off light. Like, we know that scientifically. The moon simply reflects the light of the sun. The moon doesn't give off any light. So I love, though, that Moses doesn't clarify, you know, and God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. However, the lesser light to rule the night doesn't give off light per se, but it actually just reflects light from the greater light. Like, that's not in there because it's not important. It doesn't matter. Genesis isn't seeking to give you a scientific answer for how the sun and the moon work. Genesis is seeking to show you that the sun, moon, and stars aren't gods. They're created things by the one true God. Because, so we have to remember that. Now, sure, Genesis does, right, answer scientific questions, but that's not its purpose. It's not a science textbook, right? It's to teach us worldview, it teaches us answers to our worldview questions, right? So the main point is the sun and the moon and the stars aren't God. Humanity doesn't exist to serve them. The sun and the moon and the stars are created things that exist to serve humanity by serving certain functions. Now, here's something interesting that helps shape my understanding of why these are six literal days. And it comes down to how we as humans have measured time since the beginning. The rotation of the earth determines a 24-hour day. The moon's orbit around the earth, by and large, determines our months, right? You have the cycle of the moon. The earth's revolution around the sun determines our year, right? It's 365 and a quarter days, and the earth revolves around the sun. But there is nothing in celestial bodies that determines a week, right? So we have our days, our months, and our years really coincide with the sun and the moon, right? And the earth and their relation to one another. And there's nothing in celestial bodies that determine a week, and yet humanity universally numbers the calendar by weeks. Isn't that interesting? So I think there's something even ingrained in human beings and how we measure the passage of time that echoes back to these 7 days of creation, right? We all pick up a calendar. There's no calendar in the world that says, well, actually, there's 10 days in a week. It doesn't work like that, right? There are 7 days in the week, and there's no celestial scientific reason for why we measure time by weeks. And so I think it points to, well, it points back to this original first week where God created everything. Jeremiah says on YouTube, even today, scientists look at the stars and other planets for answers instead of God. It's true. Yeah. You even think about, so in ancient cultures, they looked to the sun, the moon, and the stars, and they worshiped them. Even today, people do that. We have astrology, we have your horoscopes, we have New Age practices that look at, you know, the sun and the moon and the stars and try and figure out your future from them. So we do that today. Humans do that today as well, like they did, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. So I find it so interesting that oftentimes, and C.S. Lewis called it, he either called it historical snobbery or chronological snobbery. But basically, we look back at ancient cultures and we go, oh, they were so simple-minded back then. They didn't know what they were talking about, right? And they worshiped the sun, moon, and stars, and yet you get a newspaper and, oh, I got to read my horoscope because I don't even know what a sign is. I'm a Scorpio. And so we, as human beings, we do the same thing today, right? And yet we oftentimes look back at ancient cultures and go, oh, they were so stupid back then. How could they not see that? And yet we do so much of the same things in our day and age. It's quite fascinating. So day four, God creates the sun, moon, and the stars, and they exist to kind of serve humanity by differentiating between day and night, and being signs for the passage of time, and also giving light to the earth. So day five, we are flying through here. Verses 20 through 23, it says, "And God said, let the waters swarm with swarms of living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the heavens. So God created the great sea creatures and every living creature that moves, with which the waters swarm according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day." So, day five, God basically creates birds, and I was going to say fish, but I think it's sea creatures. I don't think it includes, or I don't think it's just fish. But again, notice, right? So, day one, light. Day four, things to fill that space. Day two, He separates water from water, so you have water and sky. And on day five, what does he fill water and he fills the sky with birds, and he fills the water with sea creatures. So again, it's this process of creating and then filling. It's beautiful how parallel this is. So God creates birds and sea creatures. Now, what's interesting, again, is the difference between the creation narrative in Genesis and the ancient world, like the other ancient civilizations, their creation narrative. In the ancient world, sea creatures were seen to, they operated against the ordered system. So actually, sea creatures in ancient mythology were seen as threats. Even last week, we talked about the Babylonian view, right, where Tiamat was the belligerent and monstrous ocean goddess, the personification of evil, and she had to be fought and killed. And so there was this idea of the deep and creatures in the deep. In the Genesis account, notice that there has been no conflict yet, right? There's no cosmic war going on. There's no sea creatures who are battling God and he has to defeat them. These creatures are a part of the ordered system. They're not enemies to be defeated and kept in check. These sea creatures are actually created, and they are completely under God's control. So it's interesting. Again, it's Genesis. It's a stark difference. It's a stark difference from other creation narratives. God is firmly in control. There's no conflict. There's no war between sea monsters and him. He creates the sea monsters and they obey him. They're completely under his control. Now, what else is interesting is verse 22. The first blessing given in the Bible is not directed towards mankind, which I find fascinating. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, we should worship the earth or God cares more about animals than people. I'm not saying that. I just find it interesting that the first blessing that God gives in the Bible isn't towards human beings. The first blessing in the Bible, God blesses the animals, right? It says in verse 22, and God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the water in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. So God blesses the birds and the sea creatures, and he says, be fruitful, multiply, right? Fill the seas, fill the sky, essentially, multiply yourself. So I think that teaches us that God cares about all of his creation. I would say God cares uniquely and above and beyond for human beings, right? His image bearers, but God loves and cares for all of his creation. He blesses the animals that he makes, right? And he says, be fruitful, multiply, fill the oceans and the sky. It's quite beautiful. So again, here's where the creation narrative departs from the popular view in our world, where, you know, the thinking is, well, evolution brought about all the sea creatures, birds, animals, humans that we see today. And our creation narrative in Genesis 1 says, no, evolution did not bring those things about. God specifically created them. So evolution would say that creatures evolved through ages-long processes. So billions of years, creatures evolved. There was actually a lecture given by a science professor at one of the most prestigious universities in Southern California. He gave this lecture describing how he believed the evolutionary process worked or how it occurred. So I want to read you some of his ideas just to give you this comparison, right? On our creation account, we have God simply creating by speech, right? He speaks things into existence. Now, this professor was convinced that the ability to fly, to swim, and to travel on land were acquired characteristics. They were the result of every life form's natural instinct for self-preservation. So he started to imagine, well, you know, the earliest complex life forms came into existence when single-celled creatures morphed by sheer accident into more complex life forms. And these more complex life forms found that they could sustain themselves by consuming the simpler life forms, and so they developed the means of moving so that they could feed. And then through a process of accidental mutations that took billions of years, some of these primitive microorganisms developed into more complex and larger creatures that eventually learned how to breathe air and move onto land to escape from predators. So he pictures, right, this professor pictures the earth at this point was populated with a variety of primitive, slithering reptiles and simple, small, creeping things, which he talks about as being, well, you know, there was probably only snakes and bugs at this point in the evolutionary process. And so then he says, well, the snakes probably started to eat the bugs, and the bugs then sought inventive ways to get away from the snakes. So perhaps, this guy says, some of the bugs grew wings and developed the ability to fly, and others burrowed into the ground. So then the snakes began to die for lack of food. So in order to preserve their species, they grew legs then and devised ways that they could climb trees and dig into the earth to get the bugs. The snakes probably eventually developed hollow bones and bodies. Some of these snakes probably developed wings so that they could fly to get more bugs. And through this process, great families of birds and animals and other forms of life developed. And so this professor, during his lecture, he said, it's all very simple. And I just laugh at that. Because in this guy's own admission, you know, probably just by luck, by chance, by accident, all of these very precise things happened over billions of years that seem, in my mind, to be very fanciful and preposterous and actually genetically impossible. And so you begin to wonder when you actually dig into, right, Darwin's work and the origin of the species and the evolutionary, right, the theory of evolution, it sounds so preposterous and so genetically impossible. And you have to ask, well, why? Why is that view considered more believable than the biblical account of creation? And here's why, I think. Fallen humanity hates the God of the Bible, and the complexity and the wisdom that is seen in the creation of the universe is the single greatest rational obstacle to an atheistic worldview. And I think even I've heard, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and other kind of well-known atheists, when people ask them about the fine-tuning of the universe and the odds of this happening, they have no explanation for it. It's just, well, we're here, so it must have happened. Sheer luck that over billions of years and possibly billions of Big Bangs, we're here, so therefore we just kind of lucked out. And there is no explanation for the fine-tuning of the universe. You know, they talk about, I think it's 27 constants that have to be perfectly in tune in order for life to happen, and the odds of those 27 constants being exactly like to the degree at a Big Bang are impossible. And atheists and evolutionary biologists go, yeah, well, we're here, so it must have happened. So I think that really the reason that the evolutionary worldview is so popular is because fallen humanity hates the God of the Bible. And the complexity and the wisdom that you see in the creation account and that you see in the universe is the single greatest rational obstacle. And so rather than actually submitting to the God of the Bible, it's, well, let's just come up with a ludicrous explanation for where we came from. So day six, I would love to, I don't know, are there thoughts or comments, or do we have evolutionists watching that I'm offending? So day six, we have this last day of creation before day seven, when God rests. So let me read. You know what? I'll read the creation of. I'm just looking at time. I don't know if. Yeah, let's just read it and see how far we get. So it says this, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping thing and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds and the livestock according to their kinds and everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Let's actually stop there. We'll save the creation of human beings till next week. Oh, I'm seeing Robert's waving hello. We'll save the creation of humanity till next week because we want to take our time through that and the idea of the Imago Dei and being in the image of God and male and female. But so let's end. We'll just talk about the creation of the rest of the animals. But so day six, God creates animals, and we'll get there, humans. So again, notice, right? Day three, dry land and things to eat. And day six, God creates animals and humans. He fills the dry land, and animals can actually survive because they can eat food. So it says, let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kinds. And so then he kind of summarizes with three generic terms: livestock, creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kind. That's kind of this generality to talk, covering all animals. So Jeremiah asked a good question. So when I plan a job out, I have to factor many different elements of a job to make it come together. Do you think God planned out building the universe and our earth, or do you think he just did it because? That's a really good question because, I mean, you look at the universe and how it's set up and how it functions, you have to go, okay, there has to be an intelligent design behind the universe, which we would say, well, it's God, because there's so many factors, right? And I in my studies, I read a bunch of different facts that were really fascinating, but just for sake of time, we don't go over them. But like you talk about the tilt of the earth and how it's perfect, and if it was 1 degree off, life would cease to exist. You talk about the distance from the earth to the sun and whatever it is, 93 million miles, or I can't remember. But if the earth was any closer, we would burn up. And if it was any farther away, we would freeze to death. The earth is perfectly positioned around the sun. You talk about like all of these things that have to be perfect within like the smallest degree. There's no room for error. So you go, you know, I don't know if God sat down and planned this all out, but it definitely shows you that God is all-knowing, all-powerful. He has all wisdom, all knowledge. He knows everything, because if he didn't, like, this couldn't have come into existence, right? It's so perfectly fine-tuned that it has to be an omniscient, all-knowing, powerful God. So I don't know if God, you know, planned it out, but you look at the you know, or if he just kind of made it happen, but it seems to be very well planned out and very well structured, right? And it seems to be set up just perfectly for human life to flourish and exist. So it's amazing to think about. So God creates livestock. So that would include, you know, cows and horses and goats and sheep and all those kind of things, domestic type animals. He creates creeping things, which it would include, well, you just use your imagination, reptiles and all those kind of things. And then he makes beasts of the earth, which would include elephants and giraffes and rhinoceroses and all those kind of big beasts. I would say my view is that also includes dinosaurs. So Jennifer, to get back to your question, you know, where do dinosaurs fit into this? That's a really good question. Answers in Genesis has some great resources on a biblical view of dinosaurs. I would love to hear in the comments some theories that you've heard from like a Christian worldview of how dinosaurs fit in. I've heard some people say, well, dinosaur bones were put there by Satan to like test our faith, which I don't think is true, but it's an interesting theory. Others have said, you know, nope, dinosaurs actually didn't exist, you know, those bones are whatever, made up. And then some Christians have said, well, the existence of dinosaurs proves that it must have been millions of years. But I don't think it necessarily has to mean that. The Bible actually, in a few places, in Job and in the Psalms, it uses a few words that could not possibly describe any human animals that we know today. It talks about behemoth, and it talks about, I'm just looking this up. It talks about behemoth, and then the other passage talks about Leviathan. Let me just look this up. Verses about behemoth. I believe it's in Job. Yes, behemoth. So if you read the biblical description, here we go. Job chapter 40. If you go to Job chapter 40, this is the description of this behemoth. Behold, behemoth, which I made as I made you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold, his strength is in his loins, and his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail stiff like a cedar. So you go, well, what kind of animal has a tail that is long and stiff like a tree? The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs like bars of iron. And it kind of continues on describing this behemoth. And so many scholars believe, well, the biblical description of a behemoth and a leviathan probably are describing dinosaurs. The idea of a big dinosaur with a tail like a cedar trunk, that very well could be describing a dinosaur. Now, I think, too, it's important to remember, like I said, you know, if you watch Jurassic Park and if you watch other movies that have dinosaurs in them, that is a Hollywoodized version of what dinosaurs actually were like. Scientists have said most dinosaurs were actually quite small. Not to say that there weren't big ones, but most dinosaurs were actually quite small. They weren't gigantic. And I actually read a quote. It was last saying that, you know, those in museums when they have the dinosaur bones kind of put together into a skeleton. Well, there's very few dinosaurs that have been found like that in a full skeleton. Most often you'll find a bone or several bones, and then scientists will go, well, we can kind of piece it together to guess what it might look like. There's this conspiracy about dinosaurs. I just think people have tried to put together what they might think they looked like, and I think we've gotten it wrong for by and large. So again, you think about Noah's Ark, it's not as if Noah, and we'll get to this in a bit, it's not as if Noah was trying to fit in two T-Rexes who were 30 feet tall into, you know, it, no, of course not. And we'll get into the number of animals on Noah's Ark and things like that. But I think it's perfectly reasonable to say that, yeah, dinosaurs existed for sure. And like other animals that don't exist today, they died off and they went extinct. So for me, there's no issue fitting dinosaurs into a biblical worldview. Jeremiah says Job talks about the behemoth and basically describes a sauropod. Exactly. That's the word that I was like, the one from Land Before Time, right? Those movies, the one that has the four legs and the big tail. exactly, a sauropod. Jennifer asks, also curious if continental drift falls when Adam and Eve sinned. I think that continental drift probably happened. I think because, you know, we've observed over time that, yeah, the tectonic plates move and the continents are drifting slowly. So did where the continents are today look exactly like, you know, however many thousands and thousands of years ago when Adam? Probably not. They've probably drifted. I don't know if it was a direct result from because Adam and Eve sinned. I think, yeah, over time the continents drift because we were able to actually observe that over time, right? We know that they're still drifting very, very slowly, but they are drifting. So, you know, you talk about Pangaea and the world was all one thing. I don't know if we should go that far. But yeah, I don't think the way the map looks today, the way the globe looks today is what it looked like. Probably not, just because of time and natural disasters and drift and all that. Yeah, it probably looked much different than what we see today. I don't know. Any other questions about dinosaurs? I know. It's interesting. So even we are so you and I swim in the culture that we live in, right? Every day. So I grew up being taught that, yeah, dinosaurs lived millions of years ago. It's ridiculous to think that they, you know, lived at the same time as humans. And so you grow up living that, right? And so it's very hard when all of a sudden you go, well, wait a second, there's actually evidence that proves to the contrary, right? So I mentioned carbon dating, and so they'll look at dinosaur bones and they'll go, well, you know, carbon dating proves that it's millions of years old. Actually, if you go to Answers in Genesis, there's some fascinating articles. There was a dinosaur bone found in the United States that still had red blood cells in it. And if a bone is millions of years old, it is scientifically impossible for red blood cells to last that long. And so actually the scientific community is scrambling to go, well, how do we make sense of this? Here's a dinosaur bone that we found that still has red blood cells in it. This is impossible. That would make that dinosaur bone only, you know, thousands of years old, 10,000, 6,000 years old, not millions of years old. So it's actually interesting that science is beginning to prove a biblical worldview if you actually dig into some of the evidence. And, you know, you talk about carbon dating and you talk about fossil records, and there are so many issues with how they date things that even scientists go, yeah, this is not reliable at all. So I would encourage you to do some digging into it. But I know, like, I was talking with one lady, and, you know, I talked about the idea that, yeah, you know, dinosaurs weren't millions of years ago. And she just kind of went, what? I have never heard that before. I said, well, yeah, of course you haven't, because you and I live in this culture that we just, that's what's being pumped at us. Yeah, and Jeremiah says, you know, the flood might have had enough force to cause the continental drift. Yeah, that's actually, that's true as well when you think about that kind of a catastrophic event, which, you know, we'll get to. So the phrase, let the land bring forth living creatures, that doesn't, again, it's not a scientific expression. It's not as if the earth just kind of like burst animals. It's just a poetic way of saying that the land is the location, you know, where animal life came from, but it's not what it's produced out of, right? God created animals, but it's just a poetic way of saying, you know, let the earth bring forth living creatures. I don't think that the actually, you know, if you've ever read the Chronicles of Narnia and the last battle, right? And when it Aslan comes, and if you know this scene, it's, I love this scene, but, you know, when Aslan, he's singing, and then the earth begins to swell, and it, like, poof, when it pops, and different animals come out. If you know that scene, let me know in the comments, right? I think it's beautiful. I wish they would make a movie out of it. But, you know, there's this big bubble on the earth, and then it pops, and an elephant comes out. I don't think that's what Genesis is saying. I don't think God, you know, literally the earth swelled and it produced animals. I think it's a poetic way of saying, this is where it happened, basically. So God makes all of the animals. Those three categories of animals cover all living creatures, all animals. And it says that they were created according to their kind, and God saw that it was good. So I think we'll leave it there, because I don't want to rush through the creation of mankind, because it's really, it's amazing. And it's really important, because it deals with gender and sexuality, male, female. We're getting into all sorts of things. So I think we'll leave it there. If there's any questions, though, I'm just going to give a minute. Any questions about these first 5.5 days of creation? And then next week, like I said, we'll get into the second half of day 6, and then we'll get into day 7, where God actually rests. But yeah, any last comments or questions from you? Thanks for the interaction tonight. I love the back and forth. Like I said, there's a few books here that you may have noticed that I've found really helpful. I would encourage you, if you want to dig deeper. This one's called The Lost World of Genesis 1, Ancient Cosmology and the Origins Debate. This one is called Reading Genesis Well, Navigating History, Poetry, Science, and Truth in Genesis 1 to 11. These two were really interesting. I didn't agree with everything in them, but it's okay to have books that you don't necessarily agree with. But these ones were really helpful. I would encourage you, if you're interested in digging in a bit more. This one's called The Battle for the Beginning by John MacArthur. Again, don't agree with everything that MacArthur says, but I found it really good. And this is written 20 years ago. And then if you're into commentaries, the New International Commentary on the Old Testament, that's on the first 11 chapters. So if you're a reader and you want more info, those are really good books I would suggest buying. So if there's no questions, Austin said, thanks for your study, Pastor. You're welcome, Austin. If there's no more questions, I'll upload this tomorrow to the website with the audio and the notes. And then, like I said, Barbara Rahm says, I wish I could read those books, but I'm so far away. Oh, yes. We should find a way to send you some books, Barbara Rahm. We can talk afterwards. But yes, we'll leave it at that. Text me or message me questions that you might have, and hopefully you have a good rest of your night, and we will talk to you next week.